The top stories: Pakistan summons a senior U.S. diplomat lodging a strong protest over America's interference in its internal affairs. Russia says it will not ask the European Union to end sanctions against Moscow, stressing that the country has a sufficient, quote, margin of safety. Plus, a Canadian Indigenous delegation urges Pope Francis to revoke centuries-old decrees used to justify the seizure of their land by colonial powers. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. Pakistani media reports say the government has lodged a formal protest with the U.S. over what it calls threatening remarks by an American official. The media said the government summoned the acting U.S. envoy in Islamabad late yesterday. That came shortly after the Pakistan top security authority, the National Security Committee, voiced concern over threatening remarks by a foreign official in a meeting with Pakistan's envoy in the U.S. Reports say an American official has told Pakistan's ambassador that the Asian country could face dire consequences if a parliamentary motion aiming to oust Imran Khan fails. A foreign ministry source says the U.S. envoy was told that such undiplomatic language was unacceptable and amounted to blatant interference in the internal affairs of Pakistan. This as Pakistani Prime Minister has rejected opposition calls for him to resign ahead of a no-confidence vote take.
People will never forgive nor forget you, nor will people forget and forgive your handlers. People will always remember that you made a deal on the country. The people here under foreign influence tried to topple a government that had an independent foreign policy.
Imran Khan says a certain foreign power wants to see his ouster because he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. That has taken, or he has not actually, I should say, openly named the alleged conspiring country. Washington has rejected claims it is involved in a conspiracy to dislodge Imran Khan. Opposition leaders have been calling on the prime minister to quit for months, accusing his government of corruption and mismanagement. A main ally of the Pakistani prime minister quit his ruling coalition on Wednesday and switched to the opposition seeking to oust him. The no-confidence vote will take place Sunday. The UN chief has painted a dire picture of life in Afghanistan, warning that people are selling their organs and children to survive.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Guterres said some 95% of Afghans do not have enough to eat, and 9 million are at risk of famine. Speaking in a high-level donors conference, he warned that Afghanistan's economy risks falling into a death spiral without urgent aid. He said wealthy countries cannot ignore the consequences of their decisions on the most vulnerable. The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan last year after the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces. The U.N. is seeking a record $4.4 billion, I should be saying, in funding for the war-ravaged country this year, but so far has received less than 13% of that amount. Earlier, journalist and author Daniel Lazar told us how the U.S. is perpetuating the Afghans' suffering and the West's double standard in dealing with the crisis.
The U.S. is embarking on a very punitive policy. America likes seizing financial assets. It's seized Afghanistan's, it's now seizing Russia's. Essentially, it's using its preeminent position in the global financial structure to strike back at countries it doesn't like. And the consequences in Afghanistan are shocking. I mean, Afghanistan is a country of 40 million people. Apparently, 95% of them are food deficient. More than 10 million children face starvation. This is a catastrophic collapse. The U.S. is doing nothing. It's not only just doing less than nothing, it is stealing Afghanistan's financial assets. And evidently, Europe and America divide the world up into two parts. There are those who have blue eyes and blonde hair and come from countries like the Ukraine, and those who are darker skinned and come from either from Latin America or Asia or Africa. And they're treated very differently.
A senior official from Russia's foreign ministry says his country will not ask the European Union to end sanctions against Moscow. Speaking to Russia's RIA Novosti, says news agency Nikolai Kobrinets, says the country has a sufficient, quote, margin of safety. Kobrinets, who is the head of the EU Cooperation Department at the ministry, said the bloc is not the center of the universe. He noted the EU might realize that a confrontation with Russia is in contrast with its interests. Kobrinets added that anti-Russia bans are negatively affecting the lives of ordinary European people. The EU has imposed packages of harsh sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's energy sector, and a halt to supplies will cause a major energy crisis. Turning to the latest developments on the ground in Ukraine, where a Russian military offensive has entered its sixth week in eastern Ukraine, pro-Russia forces are reporting significant progress. These forces claim they are in control of almost all of Luhansk and more than half of the Donetsk regions. They controlled about a third of each of the two regions before the Kremlin recognized their independence last month. Moscow has said a full liberation of these territories is now a primary goal, as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia is massing its forces for a big offensive in the eastern region of Donbas. NATO also says it is not seeing a pullback of Russian forces in Ukraine.
According to our intelligence, Russian units are not withdrawing, but repositioning. Russia is trying to regroup, resupply, and reinforce its offensive in the Donbas region. At the same time, Russia maintains pressure on Kiev and other cities. So we can expect
Stoltenberg said he expects additional offensive actions by Russian forces in Ukraine. Local officials have confirmed the death of 20 people as a result of Tuesday's rocket strike on the regional administration building in Ukraine's southern city of Mykolaiv. Russian forces have encircled the southern port city of Mariupol. They have announced a local ceasefire in the city for Thursday to allow civilians to be evacuated. Ukraine says it's sending a convoy of buses to evacuate them. Kiev says all of the Russian forces occupying the defunct Chernobyl nuclear power plant have withdrawn from the area. The Ukrainian state nuclear company says Russia has formally agreed to hand back to Ukraine the responsibility for protecting Chernobyl. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it is preparing to send a mission to the radioactive waste facility in the next few days. Russian soldiers seized control of Chernobyl soon after the February the 24th offensive. However, the plant's Ukrainian staff continue to supervise the concrete encased remains of the reactor that exploded in 1986. To other news now, the majority of EU countries have opted to grant temporary protection to Ukrainian refugees, as indicated in an EU directive that was implemented over 20 years ago. However, thousands of African and Asian people fleeing from war or from war-torn Ukraine have been left without protection, facing racial discrimination at the border with Poland.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
Per quanto riguarda l'ONU,
the UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far, and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination.
Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students.
Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
Canadian representatives of the Assembly of First Nations have urged Pope Francis to revoke centuries-old papal orders used to justify the colonial power's seizure of indigenous land in the Americas.
We call on everybody for the most obvious step and solution to the ongoing destruction from these doctrines of discovery. Here we are today to share with you that we're still alive, well, our language, our culture is strong, and we have, our elders have never given up our teaching, nor we ever doubted our existence. This is what we've been saying. The unmarked graves that you saw is a factual evidence that our people were telling the truth. We're here at this really divine moment.
The delegates made the demand during a private meeting with the Pope at the Vatican. The so-called Doctrine of Discovery declared territory held by indigenous peoples to be nobody's lands. The group says there is a direct connection between the doctrine and the disappearances and deaths of indigenous women in Canada. The delegates also urged the Pope to release all residential school records held by the Catholic Church. Following the meeting, they said they believed the Pope Francis would soon apologize for the Church's role in the abuse of at residential schools. The stated aim of the schools, run between the 1830s and the 1990s, was to assimilate indigenous children. More than 4,000 children reportedly died either from neglect or abuse in those schools. Moving on with another story now. An official Iranian delegation has concluded a two-day visit to Syria discussing prospects of expanding bilateral relations in various sectors with the Arab country. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali is in Damascus.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
To France now, election polls show that highly immigrant suburbs have joined in the nationwide turn to the right. Working class areas in general now appear ready to join with rural voters in a rejection of the city-dominated mainstream parties. Ramin Mazoheri is in Paris.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوة القرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
ولا تتفرقوا فيه
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب الله
ولقد يسرنا القرآن للذكر فهل من مدكر
Path towards enlightenment
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have currently taken up explanation of Surah Qamar, which was revealed in Mecca and deals mainly with the punishment of disbelievers of the past generations as a warning to the pagans of Mecca and also to the disbelievers of all times. With the refrain, Is there anyone who will be admonished? Running throughout the surah. The miserable fate of the disbelievers on the day of judgment is contrasted to the everlasting bliss of the believers will enjoy in the paradise. An interesting feature of this surah is that all 55 of its ayahs end with the letter R. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 33, 34, and 35, which reads,
كَذَّبَتْ قَوْمُ لُوطٍ بِالنُّذُرِ إِنَّا أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِمْ حَاصِبًا إِلَّا آلَ لُوطٍ نَجَّيْنَاهُمْ بِسَحَرٍ نعمة من عندنا كذلك نجزي من شكر.
The people of Prophet Lot denied the warnings. Indeed, we unleashed the rain of stones upon them, excepting the family of Lot, whom we delivered at dawn as a blessing from us. Thus, do we reward those who give thanks? If you remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Qamar last Friday, we dwelt on the fate of the rebellious nation of Thamud, for whose guidance God Almighty raised Prophet Saleh, but except for a few, the majority stuck to idol worship and sins. We said a nation whose members are comrades in crimes against humanity is liable to be struck by divine wrath, since none can stand against God's will, which prevails over all and everything. We also said that the Noble Quran is not a book of history, but it gives an accurate narration of selective events of the past in order to wake up human conscience to help discover the truth. The ayahs that we recited to you now refer to the miserable fate of the nation to whom Prophet Lot was sent in order to dissuade them from the abominable crime of sodomy. But they scorned him and continued their sordid sin of homosexuality, even threatening to kill him. As a result, God rescued the prophet and his children, except for his wife, who was complicit with the sinners, and then inflicted a terrible punishment in the form of a harsh gale that lifted and hurled rocks and sand to bury the whole towns along with houses and inhabitants. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the prophets were guides who saved people from error. But when disbelievers and sinners ignored the warnings and conspired against them, they were punished. Number two, it is the principle of divine justice to save the true believers before inflicting punishment upon the intransigent sinners after having granted them an ample period of respite to repent and reform. And number three, those who are grateful to God and his prophets for being delivered from darkness receive divine rewards both in the transient life of the mortal world and the hereafter, where the eternal bliss of paradise awaits them. Now let us listen to ayahs 36, 37, 38, and 39 of the same surah.
وَلَقَدْ أَنذَرَهُمْ بَطْشَتَنَا فَتَمَارَوْا بِالنُّذُرِ وَلَقَدْ رَاوَدُوهُ عَنْ ضَيْفِهِ فَطَمَسْنَا أَعْيُنَهُمْ فَذُوقُوا عَذَابِي وَنُذُرِ وَلَقَدْ صَبَّحَهُمْ بُكْرَةً عَذَابٌ مُسْتَقِرٌ فَذُوقُوا عَذَابِي وَنُذُرٌ.
He had certainly warned them of our punishment, but they disputed the warnings, and certainly they even solicited of him his guest, whereat we blotted out their eyes, saying, "So taste my punishment and my warnings." And certainly early at dawn, there visited them an abiding punishment. So taste my punishment and my warnings. Prophet Lot strove to guide the people towards the shores of salvation through his words of wisdom, coupled with warnings of divine torment. But the intransigent disbelievers and sinners allowed themselves to be misled by the ever-deceptive devil, by doubting his mission of guidance, and persisted in committing their vicious deeds until they were afflicted by divine torment. As Ayah 37 means to say, the sodomizers or the gays to use the modern Western word for the despicable homosexuals, went to the extreme in transgressing bounds by demanding that Prophet Lot hand over to them his handsome guests, who were actually angels in human form, which God had sent to seal argumentation against the abominable sins. The wise counsels of the prophet were of no avail to them, and when they shattered the gate of his house and tried to enter his home to indulge in their evil designs, divine wrath struck the trespassers, who became blind with no traces left of their eyes. As is clear by the wording of the next two ayahs, at dawn, the whole township was afflicted with a relentless punishment, as a result of which the sinners were all perished and sent to hellfire, before they could carry out their plan to kill Prophet Lot, who, in the night, had left the place in accordance with God's command to save him and a few believers. They were thus made to taste divine torment regarding which Prophet Lot had warned, and they had belied him. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, God first seals the argumentation through his prophets and then punishes the intransigent disbelievers and sinners, after having given them ample respite to repent and reform. Number two, homosexuality is an unnatural act and an abominable sin, whose consequences sooner or later entail terrible punishment. And number three, the righteous people always strive to guide the society and save it from corruption and oppression, which, when it exceeds all bounds, brings about divine wrath. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we present you Ayah 40 of Surah Qamar, which reads,
وَلَقَدْ يَسَّرْنَا الْقُرْآنَ لِلذِّكْرِ فَهَلْ مِن مُدَّكِرٍ.
Uncertainly we have made the Qur'an simple for admonishment. So, is there anyone who will be admonished? This ayah, which was also mentioned previously in this surah, following the accounts of the rebellious nations of Ad and Thamud, reiterates the meaningful and awakening statement. It means to say, we have made the noble Quran facile to understand. Is there anyone who will receive admonition and reform themselves by reflecting on the fate of the sinners, such as the nation of homosexuals to whom Prophet Lot had been sent? From this ayah we learn that the Noble Quran is not a history book, but it presents glimpses of guidance from the fate of the past nations in order to admonish people and enlighten the seekers of truth and virtue.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, the gathering of top diplomats from Israel, Egypt, the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Palestinian-occupied territories referred to as the Naqab Desert, has provoked strong reactions from Palestinian resistance groups, calling it a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots and occupation. In this edition, we will be discussing what is behind this move and what it means for Palestinians fighting for their freedom. My guests for tonight's show are Palestinian Solidarity Campaign Mick Napier from Edinburgh, and human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan from Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Napier. Now, this meeting is being held in the occupied territory of the Naqab Desert. Isn't this another stab in the back of the Palestinians?
It's not secret anymore. It's not furtive anymore. The Saudi regime is still keeping in the shadows its deepening alliance with Israel, but this is now out in the open, and it's clear that these regimes have decided that there's nothing that Israel will do which will cause them to end their diplomatic relations, their normalization. It is absolutely incredible that a regime led by Naftali Bennett, who will be one of the hosts for the event, a man who said famously, "I've killed many Arabs and I don't have a problem with that," is now hosting the leaders, the foreign ministers of three of the Arab states in the region. And it's also interesting, by the way, that they're meeting Ben-Gurion's old ranch, I forget what it's called, something sofa, because Ben-Gurion was very clear that there were no limits to Israeli expansion. He very clearly stated in a biography by an Israeli politician of him that there was no limits to be placed on Israeli expansion except that which could be achieved by military power. So these foreign ministers are meeting to really give a green light to Israel to commit increasing crimes against the Palestinian people, and also, I think, to cause Israel to become stronger, which ultimately will be a threat to not just the Palestinians, for whom it's a deadly threat, but for the whole region.
Exactly, Mr. Napier. That's absolutely correct. And Ms. Wahdan, as Mr. Napier mentioned, the presence of politicians of this caliber will obviously embolden Israel and encourage more atrocities against Palestinians. What is the motive of these Arab leaders who were once considered supporters of their Palestinian brothers and sisters, and how far do you think they would go?
I think this shows that these Arab regimes have reached a bankruptcy, a political bankruptcy, total political bankruptcy. This summit of shame, as we call it, is not going to bring any security for the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. It's not going to bring anything for the Gulf states as well, for the Egyptians and for the Moroccan together. The people of these countries actually are anti-colonialization, anti-normalization with the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. So they couldn't achieve anything after they publicly started normalizing with apartheid Israel. So it seems like Israel is going to be gaining some moral, let's say, achievements. On the ground, there was a big demonstration in the Naqab area on the Land Day. That's the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine, which is going to be celebrated on the 30th of March. It is coinciding with a military operation that was run or executed by a Palestinian from the from Bir Sheba, which is Bir Saba in the Naqab. So all these actually the resistance and the confrontations by the Palestinians is accelerating as well to defy and to confront the Israeli acceleration of their aggressions against the Palestinians in all of Palestine. The Naqab is in 1948. The people of the Palestinians there have been facing land confiscations since 1950. And the Israelis continue to expropriate more lands from the Palestinians, continue to destroy villages for the Bedouins there, like Al-Arqub, for example. It was destroyed over 200 times, and it was rebuilt again by the Palestinians. So all these measures, harsh measures, aggressive measures against the Palestinians will create resistance, will create confrontation, and this confrontation has been accelerating in the Naqab area in particular, as in all Palestine, but particularly Naqab area, and the Palestinians there has been confronting all these measures day after day. So what we are seeing is all of Palestine is going to be confronting the Israelis on Land Day and afterwards during Ramadan month. So all these accelerating, as the Israelis been saying just a while ago, the Israeli army is being put on alert because they are expecting some sort of missile attack against the summit, the shame of the summit of shame in the Naqab area, which means that Palestinians in total are refusing this summit to be taken place on their occupied land, and continue to stabbing Palestinians since actually the establishment of these monarchies as a functional state. In the few decades after the oil. So the United Arab Emirates has been established in 1972. Our connection with the land in Palestine goes back to 10,000 years, and the United Arab Emirates have been established 1972 by the will of the British colonization. In the Gulf and in our area. So there is no doubt for us that these countries are going to face, even in their countries, they're going to face confrontation, and they're going to lose the game with the Israelis. The Israelis here to gain more money from the Gulf states, while are going to lose.
I'm sorry, our time is limited, so let's go over the questions faster. Mr. Napier, I would like to ask you this question. The normalization with Israel, what does it mean for the Palestinians who are fighting for freedom, and what options are they left with to realize their goal of liberating their occupied lands?
I think they realize who their friends are and who their enemies are. Look, I think this takes place against the background of a crisis inside Washington. Washington is interested above everything else in confronting China. That's the big foe And everything else that detracts from that is a problem. America is drawing down its attention, its investments, military and economic and political, in the Middle East. And therefore, the question for the Gulf Emirates like the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and so on is, who will protect them from their own people? Who will protect them from external enemies? And they have decided that the best substitute for American intense interest in the area is Israel. So they're gravitating towards it because they correctly see Israel as an extension of American power into the region. I don't mean that Zionism is completely loyal to America, far from it. Zionism is for hire, it's not for sale. But it has been for hire to the Americans for a very long time, and that link remains strong. And therefore, if the states that were previously or up till now have been guaranteed with defense agreements with the USA are to look towards the future, they see that future as moving closer to Israel. Now, of course, there's lots of dirty poker. Morocco is going to be there because in order for Morocco to rubber stamp the dispossession of the Palestinians to give a green light to Israel, Israel and America gave a green light to Morocco to suppress the United Nations endorsed right of the people of Western Sahara to self-determination. This Sudanese government won't be there, but they've also signed a normalization deal with Israel. But that's a problem because there is a very powerful popular movement in Sudan which has prevented the Sudanese government from opening an embassy there so far. So for the Palestinians, they understand deeply and profoundly there's no alternative but resistance. Resistance in all its forms. Because actually the Israelis do not, at the end of the day, offer anything to the Palestinians except doom. Their expulsion, their replacement by Jews from around the world, or if there's not enough Jews from anybody else, as long as they're not Palestinians, and therefore they have to resist. And when they resist, they will find that the peoples of these states, the Egyptian people, the Moroccan people, are their allies, but the Moroccan and the Egyptian governments are, of course, their bitter enemies, tied very closely to America. And they're moving, the summit in the Negev, where if they look out of the window of their very exclusive hotel, as your other guest said, they will be able to see and smell and feel the rage, the ethnic cleansing which is taking place in the Naqab, a clear plan by the Israelis to remove the Palestinian Bedouin, many of whom have been involved in agriculture for a very long time. I mean, do your viewers know that in the Naqab, the Palestinian agriculturalists have faced aircraft, Israeli government aircraft, spraying poison from aircraft onto their crops. And the plan is to drive these people into concentration zones, terrible, poor, miserable, in order to free up most of the land surface for Jewish colonization. That's what these foreign ministers will be in the middle of until Monday, I believe. So the Palestinians have no alternative but to resist means possible, and they need the support of the masses of people in the Middle East and the masses of people around the world, like the California dockers who refuse to unload Israeli ships. If that spreads, Israel can be defeated ultimately.
Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Watton, do you think that there are any prospects of this summit leading to some kind of conclusion that may affect the political equations of the region?
Well, I think, first of all, the Israelis will not get anything out of this summit. The Israelis are facing existential threat in Palestine as well as in the region. The axis of resistance and the Palestinian resistance from one side are combined together to confront the Israeli expansionist policy. And the Israelis feel that this threat is getting closer and closer, and they're losing their battle with the Palestinians as well with the Arab nations around us and in the axis of resistance countries. So they have no future here except two choices, to leave the country here or to live as citizens without, you know, abolishing colonization, abolishing apartheid. This is the only choice that they have. But I think that the leaders of this apartheid regime is pushing even their own people to a confrontation, to a deadly confrontation with the Palestinians. And eventually, as we witnessed last May, during the sword operation, that the population, their population, the Jewish population, were afraid to stay in their homes. And the people of Lod, for example, in 1948, were trying to escape their city and go to other safer places. So what we are seeing very gradual and steadily, that the Israelis are retreating, although they are disclosing their plans to connect the West Bank to the, to what they call Israel. But on the ground, they're facing more and more resistance from the people. An hour ago, as it was aired just a minute ago, there was an operation south of Haifa in 1948, where four policemen were shot by Palestinians, and four of them are having serious wounds. So what we are seeing on the ground in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Jerusalem, include also in 1948, more and more resistance to the Israeli measurements, harsh measurements and aggressive measurements against the Palestinians. They think that they can suppress 7 million people in historic Palestine. And all what they see is more and more resistance, more and more confrontations. So what I see in the near future, that the Palestinians will win this war and the Israelis will retreat. We'll win this war against the apartheid Israel.
Thanks, Ms. Watson. Mr. Napier, the summit has been called at a time when the parties to the JCPOA are very close to reviving the deal. Do you think this summit can in any way jeopardize that?
You know, it's almost impossible to call. It looks like they can't. It looks like Blinken is going there to tell his client states, the Arab foreign ministers, that this deal will go forward. And he's using all sorts of forms of words, threats against Iran, in order to tell them that there's no alternative but the acceptance of the JCPOA. So I'm not an expert in that field, but everything seems to point in that direction. And if I could just add a few things. These Arab foreign ministers are meeting there with Blinken, with the Israeli government leaders, who are gloating at this. The very fact of this meeting is a stick for them to beat the Palestinians with, to say to the Palestinians, look, we have relations with these governments. You are alone. You're isolated. You ultimately will face defeat. But as our other guest has said, that's not the case. The people who win in an anti-colonial struggle like this are not those who have massive violence and massive technology and an overwhelming military edge. That was the case in Algeria. The French won the military confrontation in Algeria. It was popular revolt which drove them out. And I think this will be the case again. In case after case, it's not the people with the great violence, that's the Israelis who win, hands down. It's the people who can accept the suffering, the pain, the agony that the Palestinians are going through and still continue to resist. And these foreign ministers cannot give Israel the legitimacy which it craves. It craves legitimacy. It's born in blood and ethnic cleansing, and it craves acceptance by the world. But the only people who can give Israel legitimacy are the Palestinians, and they will not do so. Our other guest has shown eloquently that resistance is rising. If you look back at last May, when there were moves against Al-Aqsa Mosque, fascist gangs in Israel were attacking Palestinians, rockets from Gaza challenged the Israelis in a way that they never expected, and it created a degree of unity among the Palestinian people I hadn't seen for a very long time. So yes, I agree with your other guest. Israel can be defeated. It depends on Palestinian resistance and other actors in the region and beyond coming to their aid.
Mr. Napier, that was a great example, Algeria right there. You pointed that out. And Ms. Batan, the Abraham Accords are a rare Trump-era policy that was fully embraced by Biden's team. What does this mean for the Palestinian resistance group? And we have only 1 minute left.
Yeah, well, the U.S. administration's policy towards Palestinians and in other areas of the world, it hasn't changed. With Biden, with Trump, with Bush, with Obama, it's the same policy. You know, who runs the USA foreign policy is the industrial complex, is the financial companies, and it's not the people who elect, it's not the parties, it's not the Democrats or the Republicans, it's not the people who elect their representative to make these foreign policy. There is the deep state which puts forward this foreign policy, and it doesn't change whether it's Abraham agreement was signed during Trump, Biden has blessed it and went forward with it. The USA embassy in Jerusalem is there to stay. The Biden administration didn't move it back to Tel Aviv. So their policy is just the same. Who decides is mainly the military complex in the USA. And we're going to see the same treatment by the USA. Blinken is here to order Palestinian Authority to go ahead with their policies here. As I said before, the people on the ground, the people who are confronting the Israeli occupation.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time. I saw Mr. Napier also nodding, agreeing with Ms. Amal Wahdan, a human rights advocate and Palestinian activist who joined us from Ramallah, and of course from the Scottish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks for following us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.